There was nothing unusual about that Easter Sunday in 1975. The sun was shining over Hamilton, Ohio, the middle-class community about 30 miles outside of Cincinnati. Children searched for colored eggs, mothers made last-minute preparations for afternoon dinners, and families dressed up in new clothes to attend morning church services. But James Rupert was hungover and still in bed when his brother, sister-in-law, and their 8 children arrived at the cramped house that he shared with his mother, Charity. James and his brother were complete opposites. Leonard, the older of the two brothers, had a great career and a large, happy family. James was unemployed, a 41-year-old loser who still lived with his mother. He'd spent his entire childhood in the shadow of his big brother, and things hadn't gotten any better as an adult. When the children came in for lunch, laughing, talking, and aggravating the pounding headache that James was nursing after drinking too much the night before, he finally dragged himself out of bed. Seemingly unaware of the holiday festivities, James told his brother he was going to do a little target shooting and carried 3 handguns and a rifle out of his bedroom. James's vehicle at the time was an old Volkswagen that he'd recently been having problems with. There was always trouble, it seemed, with the engine. Well, most everyone who knew James was aware that the car was falling apart because he failed to keep up with the maintenance on the old vehicle, James believed that his older brother had been secretly sabotaging it when he wasn't around. He couldn't prove it. He'd never actually seen Leonard messing with his car, but he was certain it was happening. James blamed Leonard for most of the problems he had in his life, so a broken down car was just another thing he could add to the list. So when James came downstairs and walked into the kitchen where Leonard and his family were gathered, and Leonard asked him about his car, something in James just snapped. "How's your Volkswagen, Jimmy?" Leonard asked him. James didn't speak. He answered the question by shooting his brother, setting off a spiral of violence and rage that ended as the deadliest shooting spree to ever occur in a private home in America's bloody history. And it was one that left a grim and troubling haunting behind. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to Season 8, Home, which is written and performed by Troy Taylor and produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. With this episode and the season ahead, we'll be going in search of America's murder houses, where the spirits of the past still linger. Throughout the year, we'll be taking you behind the locked doors of both famous and little-known places, where murder, violence, and bloody events have occurred that left a mark on the house that echoes as a haunting. In this episode, we'll be taking a trip to small-town Ohio, and going behind the locked doors of a place with the infamous reputation as the site of the bloodiest murder house in American history. This is not an episode for the faint of heart. So if you're not prepared for the violence ahead, you may want to skip this one. You're still here? Okay, well hold on tight then, because this is a bad one. James Urban Rupert was born on March 29, 1934. His early life was sad and abusive. His mother, Charity, often called him a mistake because she'd wanted a daughter. When James was a young boy, the Ruperts lived in a long barn-like structure with no indoor plumbing or running water. His father, Leonard, raised chickens in the rear part of the house. It was the height of the Great Depression, and people did what they had to, but this didn't matter much to James. He had terrible asthma, caused by an allergy to dust and feathers, and their house had plenty of both. This made him sickly and made it so physical activities were hard for him throughout his childhood. Unable to run and play like other children his age, he was regarded as a sissy by other kids in the neighborhood. He walked hunched over from his illness, too frail to take gym class at school or play sports. He was a shy, introverted child who, from his earliest years in school, was routinely teased by other children and had few, if any, friends. He avoided all extracurricular activities, rarely attended sporting events or dances, and almost never dated girls. As if the abuse suffered at school wasn't enough, problems at home continued. His father was a frustrated, unsuccessful man who took out his anger on his family. He was violent, had a quick temper, and had little time or affection for his sons. He died of complications from tuberculosis in 1947, when James was 12 and his brother, Leonard Jr., was 14. Leonard wasn't missed. After his father's death, things at home, though, grew worse. His mother often beat and taunted James and encouraged Leonard to do the same. Let's be honest, the kid was easy to pick on, but he had every right to expect better from his family. But he didn't get it. James did poorly in school, had no friends, and was always smaller than his brother. Even as an adult, he was only 5'6" tall and weighed 135 pounds. At 16, James was so unhappy at home that he attempted suicide by hanging himself with a sheet. Well, his attempt failed, and he promised he'd never try again. Suicide was a mortal sin, after all. Instead, he just resigned himself to an unremarkable life. Well, Charity continued to berate James and to shower love on her older son, who became a constant reminder of James's own inadequacies. As he got older, his resentment for his brother grew. Leonard was, at least in his younger brother's mind, a vicious sadist and torturer. He was the enemy. He'd later swear that when he was a small boy, Leonard often locked him in closets, tied him up with rope, beat him with a hose, and sat on his head until he screamed for mercy. Was this true? There's no way to know. But James seemed to believe it had all really happened. James had trouble in school, but his math and science classes were the worst. His teachers always compared him to his older brother, whose grades in the same class had, of course, been superior. Leonard graduated from night school with a degree in electrical engineering, while James flunked out of college after 2 years. Leonard had a great job with General Electric, while James was unemployed and living with his mother. To make matters worse, Leonard married one of the few girlfriends that James had ever had, and then went on to have 8 children with her. Leonard was not only more successful than his brother, but James came to believe that Leonard was actively plotting against him, conspiring to keep him from leading a better life. His paranoia escalated in 1965 when a woman who worked at the local public library called the police and reported an obscene, threatening telephone call that she'd received at her desk. She recognized the voice as a frequent library patron, James Roper. When the police questioned him, he admitted, yes, he'd made the call. But that wasn't all he had to say. He told detectives that his mother and brother were attempting to discredit him by telling everyone he knew about the call and saying he was a pervert. They'd also contacted the FBI, he told the local cops, and said that James was a communist and a homosexual. This led to his deep belief that the FBI was tapping his telephone, not only at home, but also at the bars and restaurants that he frequented. He would later tell psychiatrists that he believed he was being followed by the Ohio Highway Patrol, the local sheriff's department, private detectives, and the Hamilton Police Department, too. Well, as they say, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that no one's out to get you. The FBI had no interest in James Roper, but the local police were keeping an eye on him. They knew he had a large collection of guns and that he was often down at the nearby river firing them off. He hadn't hurt anyone and he hadn't broken any laws. Yet. But experienced officers were nervous. After bringing him in for making the obscene call, they suggested he seek psychiatric help. But they decided not to prosecute him. They believed that James was troubled and odd, but not harmful to himself or anyone else. They had more important things to deal with than prank phone calls. James was referred to a mental health professional, and surprisingly, he kept the appointment. After a few sessions, the therapist concluded that he wasn't a threat. He wasn't hospitalized, and he wasn't medicated. He was eccentric, but he didn't seem to be dangerous. James Rupert had fooled them all. By the spring of 1975, Charity Rupert had reached her limits with her youngest son. She'd been charging him rent to live with her, and he'd fallen behind in his payments. She'd also loaned him money, and so had his brother. James had borrowed large sums from both of them after losing what little he had in the stock market crash of 1973-74. Charity was frustrated with his inability to keep a job and with his constant drinking. She told him she was going to kick him out of the house unless he got caught up on the rent. Well, this threat alone didn't push James over the edge, but it was certainly one of the things that did. Though James had endured a miserable childhood, a troubled adult life, and had access to guns, the Easter Sunday Massacre, as it came to be known, occurred after a series of triggering events. And murders of this kind, triggering events, usually occur over a period of weeks or even months before the murder actually happens. So-called family killers are often seen as gentle or passive individuals. They carefully suppress their hostility toward family members for as long as they're receiving some kind of psychological or monetary reward in return. But when such rewards are withdrawn, like being kicked out of the house or deprived of money, an explosion of anger is likely to occur. Family killers are frequently loners who depend almost exclusively on the family to satisfy their emotional needs. The threat of separation by family members is a particularly painful and threatening event. And far too often, that event leads to bloodshed. James had no way to come up with the money that his mother was demanding. He didn't have it, and it wasn't as if he had friends who'd loan it to him. He had no idea what to do next, so he went to a local gun shop to speak to the owner. People who think logically might see a gun dealer in hopes of selling some of their guns to raise the money needed to pay off their debt. But James didn't think logically. Instead, he asked the dealer about buying a silencer for one of his pistols. The man quickly replied they were illegal, told James to take his business somewhere else. The implication of this visit to the gun shop is clear. James was planning to kill someone in his family. The exact time of death was yet to be decided. It would all depend on what happened next. On March 29th, James's birthday, witnesses later reported seeing him shooting at cans with a .357 Magnum along the banks of the Great Miami River in Hamilton. He went out drinking later that night and ended up at the 19th Hole Cocktail Lounge, complaining about his life to anyone who would listen. One of those listeners, because she wasn't paid to do so, was bartender Wanda Bishop. She later recalled that James seemed deeply depressed. He talked about his mother's demands on him and her threat of eviction. He left the bar around 11 p.m. telling Bishop that he, quote, needed to solve a problem. He came back a little while later and stayed there until the bar closed at 2:30 a.m. Wanda asked him if he'd solved this problem. No, not yet, he replied. And then the next day, he murdered his entire family. On Easter Sunday, March 30th, Leonard and his wife, Alma, brought their 8 children, ranging in age from 4 to 17, to see their grandmother at the house on Minor Avenue. James stayed upstairs, sleeping off his night of drinking, while the children enjoyed an Easter egg hunt in the front yard. Afterward, they came inside, and while Charity, Alma, and Leonard finished lunch preparations, the children played in the living room. Around 4 p.m., James woke up, loaded his .357 Magnum, two .22 caliber handguns, and a rifle, and went downstairs. He entered the kitchen, where Leonard jokingly asked him about how his car was running. You know, the car that James believed Leonard had been sabotaging. He raised a pistol at Leonard's face and fired the first of what would turn out to be 44 shots. 40 of those shots struck the 11 victims of the massacre. Leonard was the first to die, and then James turned his gun on Alma, Leonard's wife and James' former girlfriend, and on his mother, Charity. They were all in the kitchen with Leonard, finishing Easter dinner. At the sound of the shots, his nephew David, age 11, and two of his nieces, Teresa, age 9, and Carol, age 13, rushed into the kitchen to see what was happening. James shot and killed them too. He then hurried into the living room where the other children had been playing and watching television. They were now frozen in shock and horror. James raised a gun and killed his niece, Anne, who was 12, and then shot his four remaining nephews, Leonard, age 17, Michael, age 16, Thomas, age 15, and John, who was only 4. The 11 murders were carried out with chilling efficiency. Each victim was first hit with a disabling shot and then finished off with a shot to the head, or in one case, the heart. Police later said that the only sign of a struggle in the house was an overturned trash can in the kitchen. The massacre took less than 5 minutes to complete. With his entire family dead, James sat down on the couch and remained there, motionless, for the next 2 hours. He admitted later that he contemplated suicide, but remembered the promise he'd made to himself years before, knowing, as a good Catholic, suicide was a mortal sin. I suppose he figured that God would think murder was okay. Instead of killing himself, he called the police and calmly told the dispatcher, "There's been a shooting." When officers arrived, he was waiting for them just inside the front door. The police chief, prosecutor, and coroner all surveyed a scene they described as a slaughterhouse. There was so much blood that one investigator later said he had to be careful not to let it drip on him as he walked through the basement because the blood was seeping through the floorboards. The murders shocked the community and made headlines across the country. Those who knew James never believed he was capable of such violence. He was a quiet, unassuming man and the perfect neighbor. James was charged with 11 counts of aggravated homicide. Although he had called the police and made no effort to run, James refused to answer any questions and was very uncooperative. His defense attorneys claimed he was mentally ill, but prosecutors had a different theory. They believed he'd planned the massacres and then turned himself in so he could claim to be insane. Since the entire family was dead, James stood to inherit from the estates of his mother, his brother, and even the nieces and nephews that he'd killed. Under Ohio law, he could inherit all of that, plus $300,000 from life insurance policies, if he was found to be not guilty by reason of insanity. All his financial problems would be solved if he could pull it off. His trial began in June 1975, and he had the choice of facing a jury or a panel of 3 judges. While the jury had to rule unanimously, it would only take 2 of the 3 judges to reach a verdict, but allegedly, James didn't know this. His attorneys later claimed they were told the judges had to unanimously agree too. Even so, his attorneys decided the panel of judges seemed the safer risk for a case that would be so emotionally charged. After all, he had killed 8 children, one of whom was only 4 years old. 3 Butler County Common Pleas judges heard the evidence and arguments regarding the massacre. At trial, James admitted to killing his family, but his attorneys claimed he couldn't be held responsible since he was insane. He'd been beaten and tortured by his older brother after their father died when he was 12. 2 psychiatrists testified that James suffered from paranoia and delusions of persecution and said he was unable to control his actions at the time of the shooting. One psychiatrist, Dr. Lester Grinspoon, added, "If there had been even more people in the house, they might have been killed too." The prosecution still wasn't buying James's insanity defense. They stuck with their theory he killed the family out of greed. He wanted the money from the estates and the life insurance, plain and simple. The trial ended on July 3rd when 2 of the 3 judges ruled that James was guilty on all 11 accounts of murder and sentenced him to 11 consecutive life terms in prison. One of the judges believed he was insane. The defense attorneys immediately appealed the conviction. They argued that the trial court had misled James and his counsel. They claim they were told the panel of judges would only be able to convict James with a unanimous verdict, the same way that a jury of 12 would have worked. James said if he'd known they could convict him with a split vote, he would have asked for a jury trial. The Ohio Supreme Court said that if this was true, and he'd been misled, James Rupert was entitled to a new trial. The prosecution appealed this ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court, which declined to overturn the state court. This meant that James was getting another trial. While appealing his conviction, James had been held at the State Hospital for the Criminally Insane in Lima, Ohio. In 1978, his attorney told reporters, shortly after the Supreme Court had refused to rule on the case, which was for his purposes the same as winning, that he didn't believe that James was competent to stand trial. He told reporters, quote, "His paranoid condition has worsened. Generally, his entire mental processes are breaking down." A new trial was granted in 1980, but it was delayed by 2 years, while an appeals court and the Ohio Supreme Court considered the defense's claim that James was now facing double jeopardy. He wasn't. So the new trial was set for 1982. This time, James opted for a jury trial, and the venue was changed to Findlay, Ohio. It seemed unlikely that an unbiased jury could be found in Hamilton, even 7 years after the murders. Defense attorney Hugh Holbrook, convinced his client was insane, personally funded the hiring of expert psychiatrists from all over the country in an attempt to get his client ruled incompetent to stand trial. His plan failed, at least partially. And on July 23rd, James was again found guilty of murder, this time by a jury. But he was only convicted on 2 counts, the murder of his mother and his brother. For the other 9 killings, he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Many people took this verdict to mean that James knew what he was doing when he killed his brother and mother, but then continued killing in some sort of blind rage. He received 1 life sentence for each guilty count to be served consecutively. His attorney attempted to appeal, citing a judicial error, but the motion was denied. James was incarcerated at the Allen Oakwood Correctional Institution in Lima, and over the years, he was denied parole many times. His next parole hearing would have been held in February 2025, but he didn't live long enough for that one to be denied. James Rupert died in June 2022 of natural causes at the Franklin Medical Center in Columbus. He was 88 years old. No one mourned his death. And if life is in any way fair, he is not resting in peace. He doesn't deserve that chance, especially because at least some of his 11 victims may not have been able to find their rest either. In the days that followed the Easter Sunday massacre, the 11 victims of James Rupert's rage were buried in the Arlington Memorial Gardens in Cincinnati. Unlike when James died 47 years later, scores of people were heartbroken by the deaths of the rest of the Rupert family. Alma's mother, Edna Alger, spoke bluntly to reporters about James. She told them, "I sometimes think I'd like to string him up on the cross like Christ and cut a little piece of him off at a time. I'd want him to bleed slowly." She speculated that James was jealous of his brother for marrying her daughter Alma because she'd once dated James in high school. Alma had been the only victim of the massacre that had been shot in the heart. Edna would later come to believe that James Rupert had claimed another victim too, more than just those shot to death in the house. Her husband and Alma's father shot himself in the head on Easter morning, 3 years after his daughter had been slain. He'd simply been unable to deal with his grief. 1 year after the funerals, the house that Charity had owned on Minor Avenue was open to the public so the contents could be sold at auction. The small, cramped house was cleaned up and carpets were placed over the bloodstains that couldn't be scrubbed away. The new owners listed the house as a rental, and the first tenants were a family that was new to the area and had no idea about the horrifying events that had occurred there. They quickly moved out. After leaving the house, they claimed that during their brief occupancy, they had been plagued by supernatural happenings. They said they'd heard voices and strange noises they couldn't explain. Lights turned on and off, doors slammed, and thudding footsteps were often heard coming down the stairs. Worst of all, they said, were the voices of the children crying and begging for someone to stop. They would not be the last family to move into the house and quickly leave. There were others, quite a few of them, over the next decade or so, and none of them stayed very long. All of them reported sounds and voices they couldn't explain, objects that vanished without explanation and turned up in other parts of the house, and items that literally flew across rooms. The place was haunted, they said. There was no doubt about it. Whether it was the rumors of ghosts or simply its tainted past, the house on Minor Avenue was abandoned for several years and was left empty and silent. The trauma attached to the house made it impossible to sell, and not just because of ghosts. A man named Dennis Snyder owned the house for a few years, and while he called the stories of ghosts and hauntings silly, he knew that if people found out about the murders, they wouldn't want to buy it. If they found out, of course. Snyder wasn't required by law to tell them. The state of Ohio categorized the house as having a psychological stigma, meaning a real estate agent or seller doesn't have to talk about it because psychological stigmas are not material fact. But Snyder lost out on sales anyway. He told a reporter, "When I was trying to sell the damn house, one of my neighbors killed a deal that people had their name on for a decent price. That neighbor cost me about 10 grand running his jaw." It turns out most people don't want to live in a house where someone was killed, let alone an entire family on a quiet Easter Sunday. Snyder, of course, said he could never quite understand why. "Like driving down the street," he said. "Do you avoid an intersection because somebody got run over there? It's just a building that something happened to me. To me, doesn't matter. I don't believe in the occult and all that hogwash." Well, in 2014, he finally unloaded the house on a young woman named Cinnamon Baker, who knew nothing about its history. And neither Snyder nor her real estate agent told her about it. Just before she closed on the house, one of her boyfriend's co-workers told her to look up the name James Rupert and the address where he'd done something pretty bad. And she did. She could hardly believe what she found out, but instead of running away, she decided to take another look at the house while she still had the chance to get out of the deal. So she returned to the place. She didn't find any strange odors. There were no bullet holes. There were no ghosts rattling chains, although there were still bloodstains in the basement where the blood had dripped through the floorboards from upstairs. But this didn't scare her away. Cinnamon decided it was like any other house. It had a history. This one just happened to have a history that everyone in town knew about. Some people slowed down when they drove by, others looked and pointed, and a few came to the door. But she simply accepted it as part of what it meant to live there. The annoying visitors, like the bloodstains in the basement, were simply proof of what happened in the past. "Sure, if I stop and think about it, it's creepy and scary," she said in an interview. "But it doesn't make me feel any less safe being there." Over time, she's learned not to let it bother her that six people were murdered where her two kids eat breakfast in the morning. She's no longer fazed that five children were shot to death where she sits to watch television before bed each night. And perhaps that's because she's never reported anything out of the ordinary in the house, as so many past residents did. Are the ghosts still there, or has she just learned to ignore them, or was she oblivious of them in the first place? Or has whatever haunting that bothered past occupants finally ended at last? Perhaps the echo of the terrible events of Easter Sunday 1975, which seemed to leave an indelible mark on the house, have at last faded away. And if that's true, perhaps after five decades, the spirits of the Rupert family can finally rest in peace after all. There's more ahead for the show, so stay with us through these important messages from our sponsors. Thanks. There's one thing that the American Hauntings podcast knows about, and that's mothers. We featured a lot of great mothers in a lot of our episodes. Pearl Curran, Julia Lemp, Sarah Moore, Marie Laveau, Jane Mansfield, Tamsin Donner, Delphine LaLaurie, Belle Gunness. Okay, maybe leave out those last two. But what I'm saying is that with Mother's Day coming soon, you need a truly special gift for your mom because, well, she's not Belle Gunness. So let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that literally turns your mom's life story into a book. So here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question in her email, the same way she sends you questions about your dating life or when you plan to give her grandkids. Anyway, these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. She replies by either typing in the answers or by recording her own voice. Then MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a keepsake book, and they can create an audiobook that uses her voice recordings, preserving her voice and her stories forever. As anyone who doesn't have their mom around anymore can tell you, having your mother's stories about growing up, being a kid, and overcoming life's challenges will be something that you and your kids will treasure. And let's be honest, your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a very cool way to share them. Honestly, I decided to try this out for myself, and I sent it to my mom, and she's not exactly a whiz at computers, but she still found it really easy to use. My mom might have had a little more unusual childhood than a lot of mothers do, so I'm really glad to have this, and I think you'll be glad to give one to your mother, too. So check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS for 10% off today. Okay, well, I'm ready if you're ready.
Ready when you are.
All right. Well, welcome back to American Hauntings. And let me just say thanks to all of you who have returned for episode 4 of our new season. I still can call it new because 4, that's still pretty new. So we'll keep it at that. But I'm the writer, narrator, creator of American Hauntings, Troy Taylor. And with me is our producer and co-host, Cody Beck. I thought I'd work on this wrestling thing.
I thought you were going to baseball.
It's a fallback job. Oh, well, okay. It could be that too.
I was going to say batting left-handed.
Announcer for something. Batting left-handed.
You know I'm right-handed and I do sports left-handed?
Yeah, no, I didn't.
That's all right.
I know people who are the opposite. Who are left-handed but bat right-handed, but probably because they were forced to as children. But see, yeah. I know people that are older than you, so...
That's true.
Yeah. Forced to be, you know, if you were left-handed, you had to be right-handed. But
yeah, so I have no excuse to be opposite. Yeah.
No, it's just weird. But that's okay.
It is weird.
That's all right to be weird. So
no, you know, well, yeah, I mean, as our listeners would know, that's kind of the community we've built, right?
Well, that is okay. True. This is very true.
It's okay to be weird. Troy, have you been blown over at all this week? Because I feel like I've almost been taken away like a kite with the wind.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Is it that windy? I don't know, dude. Not today. I have not left my desk.
Oh,
all day. Yes, I have not gone anywhere today. Well, I did. Went to the post office. That's literally it. It's the only place I went today. I've been at my desk. It has been chaos. So, yes.
Jeez, I'm thinking here's a great topic of conversation we can hit him with.
Well, you know, isn't the weather normally, but
yeah. Troy, I'm just dying over here, man. What do you got coming up? I got nothing.
Yeah, I know. I've got plenty. I'm kind of trying to keep it on the short term. The next thing I have going on. You know what? I have one more thing going on that I didn't write down because I didn't know about it when I wrote this down.
It's news.
But
to me.
On April the 3rd, there is a Netflix show that is premiering that day called Files of the Unexplained, and I have an episode in that. about the Myrtles Plantation.
Oh my gosh.
So, yeah. So I'll be on Netflix that night. I mean, I guess it'll be on and as long as the show's on there, but that's when it premieres. So if you're interested, put it in your watch list, you know, and it'll pop up for you. So
is that,
that's
is
what
that
I've
one
got
of,
coming.
Is that one? Well, first off, congratulations. Second, is that one of the ones where it drops like all the episodes at the same time?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty sure because I hope so. Cause it's been like a year since I filmed it. So, but speaking of that, I do have a secret, super secret filming thing going on the week after that, but I can't talk about it yet. So, but what I can talk about is April 12th and 13th. I have a Great Rivers Hauntings tour that night. That's the one, the newer one that we added that we do dinner at Pure Marquette, the one with all the chicken. So, which is, I know I keep referring to the
chicken. So good, such good food.
I know. So it's, I keep telling people, oh yeah, that's my favorite tour, but it's really, I like it as well as the other ones, but it's the chicken that makes a difference. So come join me because, well, you can if you'd like, but I'm really kind of speaking to the wider group of people out there. But it'll be a fun tour. It will be a lot of fun. And then the next night is an Edgar Allan Poe dinner. That's on April the 13th. And we are now doing our dinners inside the American Oddities Museum. We did our second one this past weekend, and we're ironing out the kinks, but I think we've got it. I think we figured out a system now. So, but yeah, and thanks to everyone who's been coming to the museum. That has been really overwhelmingly surprising. I mean, I'm glad people are coming. I figured people would come, but we've had a lot more people coming than I expected. It's really cool. I'm happy about that. I put a lot of work into it over a couple. How long did it take you to get this together? Oh, about 2 weeks. But I don't mention that it was 12 and 13 hour days every day.
Heavy moving and
yeah,
big space.
And lots of big things. Yeah. So, but yeah, it's been a lot of fun. But and then speaking of museum, for those of you who are outside the area, but you're thinking about coming to the Haunted America conference, I added a pre-conference after hours event, sort of. It's Thursday night. Pre-conference event that allows guests to not only experience the museum, but I'm also going to do a presentation on some of my favorite items in the museum.
Nice.
So that's going to be on Thursday night, right before the conference. It's only available to people who are attending the conference. I don't have another one planned quite yet, but maybe I'll do one in the fall or something. I'm not sure. But speaking of the conference, we would already have been long sold out at our old location. So if you are thinking about coming, we've still got workshops and tours available in addition to the conference itself, which is that alone is a blast. So if you haven't signed up yet, get signed up because we are going to run out of time and we're going to fill up again, just like we did last year, which is pretty amazing to fill up in that location because it's pretty massive. So
it's huge.
Anyway, excited about that. So, and also I've been working on the script for the next episode of Depraved, which is our Patreon show that we do in addition to this one. If you are a Patreon supporter, you get 3 full seasons of the show that we've already done. And we have just gotten started on season 4. I believe I'm up to episode 4. We post those every other week, which that means if you're a Patreon supporter, you get a new podcast from us every single week with no waiting. And this season, as I mentioned, is Depraved. It's the story. It's actually 2 different stories. It's a story of Ed Gein, the ghoul of Wisconsin or whatever you want to call him. He's got a lot of nicknames. And also the making of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So it's been a lot of fun switching back and forth. So if you're interested in Ed Gein and the movie, which was, you know, loosely based on some of his crimes, you could check that out and get signed up for it at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. And we'd love to have you on board, just like the people that Cody is just about to name.
Yes, yeah, so thank you. thank you, Troy. Thank you.
I got to stop doing that. I'm sorry.
I don't know why I used it. But thank you, really. Like, thank you so much for supporting the show. So I want to give some shout outs to our new patrons, to Robert, Denise, Tracy, Sweet Monkey, Heather, Aaron, Clem, Jennifer, Catherine, Carrie, Austin, Melody, Shadow Master 314, John, and Kat. So thank you so much for supporting the show.
Yes. Awesome. Thank you so much. We really do appreciate it. And it makes it possible for us to do another podcast. And it's also made it possible for us to have stuff that doesn't sound like our first half of the second season of the podcast. So yes. We have equipment we can actually record on now, which has been kind of fun. So,
okay. Yeah. So before we begin, let's dive into one of our listener reviews. So thank you so much for supporting the show. And when you give us reviews on iTunes, it really does help other people find the show. So we really appreciate any of your feedback. This one is
that's the main thing. Cause you know, unless they're funny, I love funny ones, but
right.
But just having them out there. I mean, it makes it so that other people find stuff and entertains us. So it's awesome. It's awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This one comes to us from Gray Goblin 6, and it is titled Must Listen If You Like Spooky History. It says, I love this podcast. I'm always looking for a show that combines history with a hint of spooky, and this is it. It feels very well researched. Troy very much seems to love telling each story and respects that most of these ghost stories are about real people. He balances respect and excitement very well. I'm still playing catch up, almost done with season 3, but I can already see so much improvement with Cody. His enthusiasm is infectious. He also has a voice that matches his face more than anyone I've ever seen. That's part of why I put this one in here, because no one's ever said that before.
I don't know what that means.
I don't exactly either.
But I like it.
Yeah, we've had a lot of talk about people saying Troy looks exactly or like the exact opposite.
Are completely different. Yeah.
But no one's ever said that about me. So thank you. I guess. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe.
I'm here for it. Maybe.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I thought he was a nerd. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. All right. Well, so let's talk about this episode.
Let's do it.
Is this a story you were familiar with at all? You've heard before?
Do not believe so, simply because this one was I've looked into some of these massacres, especially with the holidays and because everything we've been doing, but I think I would have remembered the number of the people that were involved in this. So I don't think I was familiar.
Yeah, it was big. And you know, I think what's so funny about this is, you know, you look back as to when it took place and you're talking about the 70s. And, you know, I'm finding as I move forward, because you know how my interest in crime used to be, where I just had, you know, interest in anything that happened after like 1950. But I've actually started to really get more into the 70s stuff because it is so depraved. I mean, that's like when a lot of the really famous serial killer stuff kicked off and things. But I think about this one, what I find so funny is this is the one that sort of spawned a stereotype when it comes to people, because you know, when you talk like, say, so John Wayne Gacy created a stereotype, the nice guy that lived next door. Oh, he's always such a quiet neighbor. He's so friendly. He's so outgoing. He does so many great things for the community, but nobody had any idea that he was burying guys under his house, right? So this is another guy that created a stereotype as the loser who lives in his mom's basement. You know what I mean? Except it wasn't a basement, but you get the idea. I mean, this guy's a grown ass man who is a complete and utter loser, who has failed at everything he's ever tried to do and still lives with his mother like Norman Bates.
Well, I agree with what you're saying, but something I wanted to ask about it, because maybe I'm taking this in a different way, but I feel like this guy never had a chance.
Well, yeah.
Or am I giving him too much sympathy?
No, maybe, I think you're giving him too much sympathy. I think that everybody has a chance. But yeah, no. But I mean, don't get me wrong. He's a really shitty family. But we're basing this family story, and I kind of hinted at that a little bit later. Basing it on his version of events. I mean, honestly, I don't think so his brother married his... He says girlfriend.
Right.
It was, and her mother said it was a guy that she knew a little bit. Just because he had a crush on her doesn't make her his girlfriend. That's his warped way.
Except in his mind.
Her.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. And
okay.
So his brother marries her and has this happy marriage. Great job. All these kids. Does he sound like somebody who really spent his entire growing up years tormenting and torturing his younger brother? Not really. You know, yeah. I think this kid grew up in a shitty place and his mother sounds awful. And I think his dad was awful. Mm-hmm. I don't know about his brother, if his brother teased him at all. But see, here's the thing, though. We're supposed to take his word that his brother was a sadist and tortured him all the time. But on the other hand, this thing about the car, that's all in his head.
Yeah, that's a good
He's point. The one who thinks his brother is sabotaging his car. I'm telling you, with all those kids, old Leonard had plenty of other things to worry about.
So he was probably paranoid from the beginning and everybody's out to get him. And
yeah. When I said, you know, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean no one's out to get you. I meant the cops were watching him. I don't mean his brother was, you know, trying to ruin his life and all this stuff. And this guy is a freak. I mean, he's obviously a freak. He is. Well, I mean, let's leave out the fact that he murdered his entire family. Let's just go with the fact that he's like this, you know, little sickly guy who's unhappy, you know, I mean, set himself up to be teased in school, you know, ended up with all these things that runs through his head. Oh, his mother loved Leonard Moore. We don't know that. We only have his version of the events. And I don't think they're accurate. I really don't. You know what? He never mentions the fact that or doesn't explain why he's calling a woman who works at the library and, you know, obscene crank calls and stuff to this woman. He doesn't explain any of that. He doesn't explain that he's a wacko with all these guns. I mean, the cops were watching him because they knew how weird he was. You know, and so they were nervous about what's this guy going to do. And honestly, I got to give them some credit. I mean, that's a small town police department. I got to give them some credit in the 70s for keeping an eye on stuff like that, because there weren't that many warning signs. There weren't a lot of people. I mean, you know, you got Charles Whitman up on a tower in 1966 shooting people in Austin, but you didn't have a lot of that kind of stuff going on yet. You know, there were no school shooters or very few. I mean, that kind of stuff just wasn't happening. But the police were already keeping an eye on this guy because there had been enough people who were alarmed by the way he was acting.
Yeah, and they don't even do that now.
I know, right? And so, yeah, so give these guys some credit here.
So you are putting this in a different perspective, because at first I was thinking like, well, he's being picked
up. Oh, this poor dude. Yeah, no, yeah. No.
But now I
don't see it.
Now I see where you're coming from. He is the prototypical, Elliot Rodgers type bullshit. I mean, maybe not rich or whatever, but just.
But yeah, that same kind of thing. And, you know, we're going to have that come up again toward the end of the season. Mm-hmm. We'll have another version of events, all from the mind of the killer, you know, that no one else saw these things. See, no one else ever mentioned. There aren't any other reports of, you know, abuse or there, you know, nothing like that was ever filed. You know, I mean,
was the suicide attempt real?
Well, I mean, maybe, but he tells that story.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else tells it. Nobody else talks about how he decided to kill himself. He tells the story later to his psychiatrist. You know, all this stuff is based on what he told his psychiatrist as he was trying to, you know, get out of committing these murders. You know, I just think, and do I think the guy's probably a little nuts? Yeah. And I don't think the jury is completely off base when they decided that
the murders
of the mother and the brother were insanity because he drove himself crazy. The rest of that stuff, though, that's just depraved shit. There was no reason to kill all those children. There just wasn't.
Yes.
Or his sister-in-law. There just wasn't.
You know? And I want to get to that, but there's a couple of things I want to talk about before.
Sure. Oh yeah, for sure.
Because of that. Okay. You said in murders of this kind, triggering events usually occur over a period of weeks or in months before the murder actually happens. And then when the rewards are gone, they snap. Right. And so I hadn't really thought about it in that way.
Yeah. Before. And when you're thinking of it as this guy feeling like his whole family's out to get him, you know, but as long as he's got a free place to stay, which he does, and he's borrowing money, which again, never mentioned early on, that he's borrowing money from his mother and his brother, and he owes them a lot of money that he can't pay back. And he's got this shitty car that doesn't run right, et cetera, et cetera. It's just one thing in his mind that's piling up and piling up, one thing on top of another, but he's still got this you know, this reward. He's still got them giving him money and giving him a place to stay and feeding him and making sure that he's got everything he wants. But now mom says, hey, look, you know, you freeloaded all this time. You need to get a job. And you need to start paying me back, or at least start paying some rent. Well, suddenly he sees that as, you know, once again, the family's out to get him. And that's when he snaps. Yeah. And that's the case with a lot of people like that. I mean, that's, as I mentioned, family killers. That's, you know, it's always the nice guy, the quiet guy that lives next door who just snaps one day. Well, he really wasn't. All along, this stuff was building. All these grievances were building up in his head. You know, but he kept quiet and he never said anything about it. He just stews on it. Just like all the things that I described in the opening, which is like a bio for this guy. Mm-hmm. But again, it's just a bio from his point of view.
Right.
So, yeah, that was kind of the idea here to try to explain all of these grievances that were building up for this guy that finally pushed him over the edge. So do I think he's crazy? Absolutely. Do I think that gun laws should take into consideration, you know, people's mental illness? Absolutely. But this was 1975 and nobody knew that then.
Yeah.
Although the cops did, they were keeping an eye on him because there's a dude out here with a 357 Magnum shooting cans.
Well, I think
you have any idea how big of a gun that is?
I was going to say, yeah. I think, you know, saying piling on grievances, I think, is a great way to describe it. And that was my next thing, is he tries to buy a silencer or a suppressor and then doesn't get it. But the next thing he's doing is shooting a 357 Magnum.
Yeah. I mean, these are like Dirty Harry kind of guns.
They are so loud. You know,
yeah. So the reason the cops are watching him is because everyone in the surrounding blocks can hear this gun going off just down the street where he's shooting cans by the river, which is so dangerous, it's not even funny. But let's leave out the fact that, you know, that there are neighborhoods around and people in, you know, possible range of bullets. But this is a big ass gun. And I'll bet you anything he bought this gun because he saw one of those Dirty Harry
movies. Oh, sure.
And it made Clint Eastwood look like a badass in it because he's got this huge handgun.
Yep.
And that was something that ran through, you know, you'll find that more than once mentioned in, you know, crime stories from around this time period, that had an effect on people, you know, because it was so macho. That's not something that you normally saw. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the name of one of the damn movies is Magnum Force. So this became like this, you know, this thing that people wanted to make them seem manly. You know, mm-hmm. everybody wants a Magnum because it's a name you can remember, right? So you got a 44 Magnum, you got a 357 Magnum, and people can brag about that kind of thing. And even people who don't know anything about guns, but who watches a movie, they know what that means.
Right.
Or, you know, if you sit and tell somebody about all the different brand names of guns you have, now we can talk about, oh, I got a Glock, you know, a plastic piece of crap. But I know that I have it because, well, all these gangsters in the movies have them.
My Glock's awesome, by the way.
Yeah, right.
It is. But this is interesting to me. There's a couple different things we'll dive into with this. But so he wanted the suppressor for this. But I'm guessing he wanted it for one of the 22s, which you can't put a suppressor on a 357. So why did he go to the opposite end?
I don't know. That's a good question. Because, yeah, well, and, you know, he's got the two 22 calibers that he uses during the shooting.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have to reload.
Right.
And but I'm assuming, like you said, I assume that's what he wanted, the suppressor.
Maybe from some other thing he saw where it looked.
Maybe. Cool. Or, yeah, it could have been a different gun altogether. I haven't seen a list of everything he owns. For all we know, those aren't all his guns.
Right.
He may have had more, but that's just what he used in the massacre.
And is that what he was, borrowing the money for, just to buy guns?
It's hard to say. Well, it's one of the things he did. Well, he bought a bunch of stocks.
Oh, okay.
And so he bought some stocks when he was working before he lost his job. He'd bought some stocks and then they tanked. Because there had been a recession in the early 70s, and there's a whole big history of oil embargoes and all kinds of stuff that we don't need to talk about today.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on during that time period.
And okay.
We lost a lot of money, so he's now borrowing money from his mother and his brother to live on, essentially, because he lost all his money that he had. But probably he was still buying, well, if nothing else, he was buying ammunition because right. he was spending his time down at the riverbank blowing off cans and bottles. So
that's something I wanted to ask you about. And this is, you know, this is a hard thing to talk about or whatever, but when we've talked about other people and just from knowing true crime and that sort of stuff, he, you know, I guess he was practicing a lot and all that, but to shoot 44 times and only miss four shots.
Yeah.
He's either very, very close.
He's very, very close. The house is, I don't know if you've seen a picture of the house, but
I figured it was small, but
like
still.
It's like this practically a shotgun type house where it's living room, kitchen, you know, and that's it in a row. And then it's got bedrooms upstairs. It's so small.
Yeah.
So, it's a very cramped house and you've got to let, you know, all these people in there. You got 12 people in the place.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't miss because how could you? Because he walks into this tiny little kitchen and shoots three people.
It's just so
then
personal.
Shoots two more kids as they come walking in, and you know what I mean. And it's just one after another after another. So
it seems so close and personal.
Like, absolutely.
Which makes it even crazier, It takes another kind of lunatic.
Yeah, it's not crazy in that he couldn't help himself. It's crazy in that this guy is evil.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Killing these kids is evil. Again, he's got a grudge against his mother and his brother. I get it, you know. So I think that's when that last jury finally said, okay, well, I could see that one, but the rest of this stuff, there's no excuse for.
Right.
You know, there's no excuse to shoot Alma or any of those kids. There just isn't.
He got his revenge.
Other than you are evil, you know. Yeah.
He got his revenge. He could have ended it then and just let everybody else live.
I mean, that one kid was four.
That's yeah.
What's a four-year-old ever done to you? You know, I mean, not that
even I won't make jokes
all
about
the rest of them, you know.
Yeah.
That's, you know, kids ages from, you know, what, like 9 up to 17. And then you got a four-year-old.
Yeah.
Insane. I mean, and just depraved. It really is.
Yeah, absolutely. It takes less than 5 minutes. One thing that this is where we get into the territory where you and I, one of us usually will bang our heads against the wall trying to get into the mind of somebody. But when he's sitting there for those 2 hours, what do you think that's like?
I don't know. That's a good question. Apparently, he was sitting there thinking. I am not sure, you know, what it was he was thinking about. Apparently wasn't sorry for what he did, but he, you know, he says later that he says he contemplated suicide, but probably not. Probably my, if I had to guess, just because I feel such hatred toward this guy, but my guess is that he said that just because that looks good for his claim of insanity.
Mm-hmm.
Just like his other so-called suicide attempt. You know, but, you know, just like saying that, oh, well, you know, years before he decided not to because it was a mortal sin. Is it murder? I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not a
he didn't read the whole thing.
But yeah, I'm pretty sure murder is too. And when you murder other people, that seems worse than suicide to me. I don't know. That's just me. But
I never thought about it. But yeah,
that, but certainly seems worse. And then when he calls the police. He just says there's been a shooting. He doesn't say, by the way, I shot 11 people and their blood is dripping through the floorboards into the basement. But, you know, hey, and then never answers any other questions.
Yeah.
You know, that's all he says. And then they come and arrest him and, you know, and they walk in and he's just sitting there, you know, but and, you know, the prosecutors think he did it for the money because, you know, which. I'm hit and miss. I go back and forth. It depends on the case. Sometimes I think prosecutors are way off base and, you know, get completely, you know, focused on one person. And when they have it wrong, they don't admit it.
Just double down.
Yeah. But I also think, you know, half the time defense attorneys are scum. So, I mean, it goes back and forth. On the other hand, I also think some of those people are doing God's work, you know, when they're getting innocent people out of prison. So you just, you know, there's no rhyme or reason to it. But in this particular case, I think these prosecutors were onto something because if he could have gotten off with insanity, he'd gone to a hospital for, you know, who knows how long until they decided he wasn't crazy anymore. And then they'd have let him out. And then he'd have had all that money. Really? It had been sitting there gathering interest. So that was Ohio law at the time. He would inherit it, the $300,000 from all the life insurance policies, if he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. So he wouldn't have any more financial problems, and it would sit there and draw interest until they let him out of the hospital, which eventually they would have because they're overcrowded, and he would have suddenly had this, you know, complete change of heart and change of life, and suddenly he's cured. So that's what they thought when they went into this thing. They always believed that he wasn't crazy, that he was doing it for the money. Now, in other cases, sure, they will often discount insanity when an insanity exists. But I get that too. I get the urge to do that kind of thing. They're trying to close a case here, and they want somebody to be punished for what they did. But in this case, I don't buy this insanity defense. I just don't. I don't. I think this guy has made up all this stuff. I mean, I think he's a nut. He's a gun nut, but I don't think he knew that it was wrong. I don't think that, see, that's your definition. You have to, you know, say this guy did not know right from wrong when he committed these murders. He did. He had to have known this was wrong. He's killing children. How do you not know that's wrong?
I would liken it. This is a little bit different, but like a Timothy McVeigh, like bonkers, but knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Calculated. Which is how the jury found him. You know, yeah, sure, he's nuts. There's plenty of people out there that we can say. There's a difference between saying somebody's nuts and someone is actually mentally ill.
Right.
There's a big difference there.
Well, I think you're now that you mentioned, I think the financial aspect might actually ring true with me a little bit more, because I would think that this guy would have shot at the cops, tried suicide by cops, yeah, something like that.
But something. If he was really, was really crazy and he really wanted to die, he didn't have to kill himself. He could have walked out of that house when the cops got there with a gun in his hand and refused to put it down.
Right.
That would have taken care of the whole problem. He did not do that. Instead, he spent years getting new trials, getting delays, coming up with this, you know, sob story about his life. I just don't buy any of it. I just don't, or very little of it. I'm not saying that he didn't have asthma or that he wasn't a loser, lived in his mom's basement. What I'm saying is that I really don't think anybody was ever torturing him except in his own sad little world.
Yeah. So. You have convinced me. I didn't have sympathy for him at first, but I was just wanting to clarify some things.
Yeah, no, I got what you're saying. I understand what you mean. I'm just not buying it. Don't buy it.
No, so. I get it. But okay, we're going to talk about some of the ghost stories and the spooky things. Would you have lived in a house like this?
Well, not that house, because it's a dump. But if it was a house where 11 people had died, listen, every time I watch Sinister and I do rewatch it, I would live in that house. And that's a problem, because then I would have ended up just like Ethan Hawke. But that wouldn't scare me away.
11 people even?
I feel like
for me, there's a number. And yeah, I
don't know, man, because I think that the people would paint me as a real sicko if I purposely moved into a house where 11 people had died, considering what I do for a living.
But that's
kind of like Ethan Hawke's wife did in Sinister.
And the cop initially.
That's so what you would. It's a little twisted, but you know, hey, if you live in an old house, there have been plenty of people who've died in that house. Now, were they murdered there? No, probably not. I know it is different, but I don't know. I don't think I would be quite as blasé about it as the woman who I talk about that lived there toward the end, Cinnamon.
Yes, I love that.
But I do love the guy who owned the house, who didn't live in it, but was really mad at the neighbors. I love that guy.
He's a great character.
He cracks me up. Yeah, he'd have been a great character in a movie, man. But yeah, so I don't know, man. That's a good question. And I know that, you know, there are bloodstains they couldn't clean up, you know, and things. And I don't know. It's That's a good question. I'll have to think about that one.
I just wondered if there was.
I probably would, but I would feel bad about what people would think of me for doing it. I guess that might bother me.
That is interesting. Yeah, it wouldn't be you're scared. It's like, oh, what?
Yeah, it wouldn't be that I'm scared of it because it wouldn't be that. I think it would be the perception of me purposely moving into a house with 11 people dying.
I haven't even considered that part of it. I think I was trying to figure out how many people had to have been murdered here before I'd be like, nope, that's one too many. I can't do it.
Yeah.
Was there anything else you wanted to talk about with that story, that Happy Easter story?
I don't think so. It's no surprise that the house, you know, got a reputation for being haunted, you know. But, you know, and then again, if you think of it, if you want to sit and think of it logically, you think that kind of like you did and by asking me, did some of those tenants who moved in, did they move out quickly because they found out what had happened there? Because, you know, that's something that happens a lot, well, in the movies and that kind of thing. And it happens in real life. People find out, you know, bad things happen and they're ready to go. Except for white people. White people love that shit. They never move out. They don't care. You know,
so dumb.
I know. So it's just one of those things. I always make that joke and people are like, oh, that's a racist joke. No, it's not. It's actually the opposite of one because it's not a racist joke. It's that white people are dumb sometimes. We all are. We can't help it. And just like me sitting here going, oh, yeah, fuck wouldn't bother me. You know, so here we go. I'm the idiot. So,
hell yeah.
But yeah, so. You know, when the woman who, you know, who did move in, you know, she didn't know about it when she looked at the house until her, you know, a coworker of her boyfriend said, hey, have you heard of this guy? You might want to Google it,
by the way,
you know? And so she did, but then it didn't stop her. So I don't know, maybe she just got used to it or maybe she just got a really strong will. I don't know. She said that, but see, here's the thing though. For her to move in and then go, oh, yeah, but I don't think it's haunted. I haven't had any ghostly experiences here. Yeah, but you're obviously clueless because you're, you know, as I make a note here that this is a woman who is having breakfast in a room where six people were shot to death, you know, and watching TV in a room where the rest of them died. You know, it's like, so she's completely doesn't phase her at all. So why would a ghost phase her? She probably wouldn't even notice. They could be dancing around rattling chains. She'd probably never know it.
Interesting.
But all those other people, you know, they may have. I don't know. It's hard to say. But the story's there. I mean, the stories are there. We just don't, you know, there just aren't any more being told because she doesn't tell them.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. Anyway. Mm. So it's an interesting story. And it's an interesting house, you know. And it's still around. I mean, it's one of those places that people still drive by and take pictures, according to Cinnamon. So, you know.
Gosh. Well, such a lovely holiday story. But it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Happy Easter this weekend.
Happy Easter.
Yeah. Coming up this weekend.
I won't tell your kids that rabbits don't lay eggs, but it is now time
for I don't think that the Easter bunny lays the eggs. He just delivers them. Somewhere there are Easter chickens, I assume. He's just sort of the delivery device. He's not the guy. He didn't lay the eggs. Come on now.
Oh,
except in the Cadbury commercials.
That would be ridiculous.
Yeah, that would be ridiculous. Bunny in a suit.
I take it.
Just deliver stuff. Yeah, come on now.
The pastel chickens.
yeah.
It is now time for our Ghostwriter segment. So if you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at American Hauntings Podcast.
Brown chickens lay chocolate eggs. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Or any farm animals. We can help you out with that.
Where do you think chocolate milk comes from? Brown cows. See, same with eggs. So go ahead.
I don't want to eat or drink anything anymore now that you got me thinking about it this way. This one is titled Books and it is from William. And it just says, is it possible to get a book signed by Troy? I recently discovered the podcast and love it. I know you do that sometimes, usually for
new. Oh, no, I do. No, when anybody orders books from us, anything you order from us, I sign them before they get mailed out. I don't let them go out. And if I'm there when you're signing books, I'll absolutely sign them. If you bring them back to someplace where I'm at, I'll absolutely sign them. I don't mind signing things. I mean, I will say I do believe it lessens the value of the book if I sign it, but I'm more than happy to do it. It's never a problem ever. So I'm flattered that someone would want me to. I'm just happy they want to buy it, you know, let alone one that's signed too. Shit.
So, I think the first few that I bought from you, I asked you to sign them and you thought I was like trolling you. And I was like,
I didn't. Oh, yeah. You. Yeah. Yes. I thought you meant like as a kid. No, as an adult.
Oh,
yeah,
no,
I
no,
thought
no.
You were trolling me.
You're I was right, being so. Serious. Have you ever done? Did you ever do that author thing where you see your book somewhere and like in a store and sign it?
No, I wouldn't want anybody to see me doing it. I just would feel weird if somebody
I see
saw
that.
Me doing that. I know that like a lot of authors I follow on like the, you know, the hellscape that used to be Twitter and stuff.
Yeah.
I know a lot of them do that in airports and stuff like that or places where they see their books. And I've had people who are friends with me, they go, oh, you should sign them. And I'm like, I don't know. I just feel weird. If somebody saw me doing it, I'd just be embarrassed.
I think I get that. To a certain
it's
degree.
Not my thing. It's just not me. Oh, no. I'm not that big of a grandstander, I don't think. So,
well, there you go, William. That you got your answer.
But Drew, yes,
you have some other input from some of our fans. Yeah.
Yeah, we do. We have the hotline that we're always plugging and it works. And I have so many. I am not sure I can do them all. So we have a ton. So I'm just going to kind of set a time limit here and see how many I get through and we'll save the rest for the next time. But please don't stop sending them. We love to get them. Like I said, some of them I do answer, you know, ahead of time. I don't save for the show, but I try to save as many as I can. And if you want to send us a text, if you've got a question that's, you know, some kind of quick question that you didn't send to Cody, you always send it to the email. Or you can text us something quick on the hotline, and that number is 217-791-7859. So let's see what we can get through here. So the first one I want to read. Oh, nope, that's a picture. That's the one, a picture of you and I that somebody sent us.
Oh, I love that picture.
Yeah. All right. So this one comes from the 618. That's kind of home territory for us. And this one says, no name on this one. So we're just going to go with 618. It says, enjoy the show. I've been listening since your first season and listening to your old Slave House episode. I'm from Harrisburg and have been there many times. We took school field trips to it every year for a while. My wife is from Shawneetown and her dad was friends with George Sisk and their families. They would get together at the house. She said she was very young, never had any experiences, but she could have and not known it. They never went upstairs, just down in the living room in the kitchen area. Can't wait to get back to Alton to tour your new museum. So thank you for sending that. But I was glad I have gotten quite a bit of feedback about the old Slave House episode. And I assumed I would just because I knew that we had a lot of listeners down in that area. And I had a feeling we'd start hearing from people, you know, who remember going there as a kid. So, all right. So this one is from Bryce in the 480. He even says he's from Tucson, which is Thunderbird and cowboy country. He said, a big fan, longtime listener of the show, love the history. The Velisca and the Limps are my favorite, but everything as a whole is awesome. And I also like the bad reviews people used to leave. Mad at you for having different social/political opinions. I could tell we're not on the same side of the fence with everything, but like you used to say, it's a free show. Hilarious. They spent time leaving bad reviews. Get a life, am I right? Anyway, home has been been a fantastic season so far. If I had $5 to bet, you'll be covering the Borden house eventually. So if you read this, maybe save the text till then. So I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is I'm not going to give away too much here.
Okay.
I'm just going to say that he kind of feels the way I do and kind of likes a theory that's in my book and then adds, all we can do is speculate. I know, but I'm curious as to what your thoughts are. And well, you'll get them because yes, it will be included in the season. So that will be later on though. So anyway, Bryce, this says, keep up the good work. Thanks for the awesome free show.
How great is it that people can disagree with us on some things and still listen
and still
to us?
Act normal? Yeah.
Thanks,
this one is from the 602 and it says, hey, Troy and Cody, love the show. Look forward to it every week or every other week. Have you thought about doing anything on the Old West? Well, maybe that's, you know, we have many seasons to go still. So you just never know what we'll end up doing. So that is maybe somewhere down the line. So this one comes from Eddie in the 678. And it says, hey, Troy, I have a question about Ed Gein. Why was he considered a serial killer when he only killed two people and suspected of killing his brother? That's a good question because he's not a serial killer. And I don't think he is one. And I've said that many times. Ed Gein was not a serial killer. Even if, you know, no matter how you want to look at it, dude was crazy. There's no question. And this dude really was crazy. I mean, there's no, yeah. But yeah, all the things that he did, most of what he did while he did commit a couple of murders, may have killed his brother, may have been involved in a couple of disappearances, but that's a stretch. And I don't believe it's probably accurate. But as far as I know, two murders we can prove, one that we can't, does not a serial killer make. Anyway, all right. So this one is from the 865. And this is, hey, Troy and Cody, just want to say how much I love the podcast. My all-time favorite season so far is Villisca. That story is just so disturbing and yet fascinating. I recently started getting your books. Just want to say reading your books is like listening to the podcast. Yeah, you hear it in my voice. You don't read it in my in your head. So they love the writing and the research. I'd also say I also like to say I love the discussion at the end of the stories. Cody asked most of the questions I keep thinking of myself. So both of you keep up the good work. I'll continue to listen. Your list podcast listener, Amanda. So that was Amanda in the 865. I did not read ahead. So
thanks, Amanda.
Yep, absolutely. This one is from Melissa in the 254. Man, I'm getting through these. So I'm now starting the new episodes for this year. It's so cool hearing my text on the podcast. Well, you just heard it. So there you go. Can't wait to hear about my home state of Texas. Can't remember what all's on there, but you probably will at some point. All right. So this one is from Chad in the 618. It says, first off, new Patreon supporter and overall supporter of American Hauntings. Recently discovered Alton, and just as you said, something just draws you back. Your historical approach and search for truth in relation to hauntings, in my opinion, is perfect. Just listen to the Crenshaw House, and having grown up in Southern Illinois, I can relate on childhood memories. This episode took me back in time to my youth, so thanks for that. We visited the old slave house as a school field trip and once with the Boy Scout group. This led to many other memories, so keep up the great work, and thanks for all the info on the area.
Nice.
Yeah, I just saw Chad at an event we had recently. So
awesome.
Yeah. And this one, oh, this was an easy one. So this one is from the 650. Says, you are the best, both of you. I love your show. 5 stars.
Oh.
No. All right. So this one, a little complicated, but not too bad. But it is, I get what he's going for here. This is from Gerard in the 757. It says, there was a total of 21,156 reported homicide cases in the U.S. in 2022. With so many to pick from, how do you choose which cases to report on? What piques your interest? Has there been a case that did interest you only to discover it was too mundane to write about? If one can use mundane when talking about murder. Mm-hmm. Well, for starters, I would not write about anything from 2022. Because yeah, that doesn't interest me. So
we barely got you to 75.
Yeah, right. So that's just as a quick thing.
Rule of thumb, yeah.
But what piques my interest is usually just something unusual. That's why I love disappearances so much that are unsolved, strange murders that are unsolved. Those are the kind of things that pique my interest. And yes, I have often started researching stories that seemed like they were a sure thing, that they were really going to be great to write about. And then once I started to get into them, the story just wasn't there. It didn't go anywhere. And, you hate to say mundane because it is a murder and it's someone's loved one or friend or family. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, I want to research and write about things that really interest me, because I feel like if they really interest me, then I will show that interest in what I write, and then they'll be interesting to other people. So that's kind of how I have to choose. I mean, there's probably more criteria than that, but that's kind of where I'm at on it.
So I would say you probably also have to have a pretty decent memory, at least, to be able to then connect patterns, which I know is something.
Yeah. And I do like to do that too. And yeah, that's how I've kind of stumbled on some different things, you know. And well, and I think that a lot of people know from me talking about it, I love axe murders.
Yeah, yes.
It's a thing. I've done 2 books on axe murders. My third one comes out in a couple of weeks. That one's about the servant girl Annihilator. And I had so much fun finding new suspects, ones I hadn't read about 1,000 times, because nobody has any, because there aren't any. Nobody knows. It was just too long ago. And, you know, there wasn't any, but I think there were some people worth talking about. So I dig into them in the book. It has been, that was a fun book to write. It really was. So yeah, that's coming out in a couple of weeks. But anyway, last one, we made it. So this one is from the 270. And it says, hello, love the show. In the last podcast, you mentioned the New Madrid Fault and how we're overdue for an earthquake. I remember when I was in school, somewhere around 1990, a man named Eben Browning thought he had it figured out how to predict earthquakes. He said there would be a small one in October and a large one in December. We got the small one, so they canceled school those couple of days in December, but thank God no earthquake. Yeah, which is funny because, yeah, that is one thing. It's like tornadoes. You can't predict them. You can react to them, but you can't predict them. You can say that the weather is, you know, ripe for a tornado, but you can't predict they're going to happen, and you cannot predict earthquakes. No one has been able to figure out how. The person, the scientist who figures out how to predict earthquakes will win the Nobel Prize. There's no question about it. But so far, no one can predict them.
Unless he predicts that it's going to happen before they have the Nobel Prize.
Right. Well, I think this guy got lucky on one of them, you know, and so he probably figured, everybody thought, oh God, if he got one right, man, this dude has figured it out. Well, he didn't, because again, can't predict earthquakes. So yeah. It's too bad, but that's why we sit around and go, as we talked about in the last, in that old Slave House episode, we're in trouble. If there's another massive earthquake on that fault, and, you know, based on how they've happened in the past, you know, we could be due for one.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's something that is, that if you think about it enough, can keep you up at night. But I actually got a better one. Remember I told you how if there was a big earthquake that it would like divide the country in half, because a big part of the middle section would just collapse and would be gone, and it would be part of the ocean. You know, there's a huge system of volcanoes underneath Yellowstone National Park, right?
Yes.
And what'll happen if they ever erupt?
I mean, if I just figured we'd all die.
Yeah, we will. It will destroy North America.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, because between the eruptions, the earthquakes it would cause, the lava flow, and all the ash and the chemicals fallout, that it would shoot into the air, it would kill everybody. So yeah, it's a very active volcanic system. I mean, you know, Old Faithful, hello, goes off every day, several times a day at the same time. They know when that's going to happen, but nobody knows when those volcanoes are going to erupt. So let's just not think about it too hard, because again, that could keep you up at night.
Well, just let other scientists and other people that want to do that stuff think about it.
Well, they can think about it. We will just not.
Yeah.
I'll just wait for the next ice age instead, because, you know, except I don't think we're going to have, you know, I don't know how it's going to work.
I don't like the cold.
They keep talking about ice ages, but, you know, I thought everything was warming up.
You're thinking of the movie?
So if it's all warming up, then that's kind of scary.
Are you thinking of the movies? Ice Age?
Maybe. I don't know. No, thinking about, I don't know. I must have read it somewhere. Oh, well, who knows? So I don't know. All I know is the icebergs are all melting and the oceans are rising, and soon, you know, we'll have beachfront property in, you know, Ohio.
So. Have you seen people freaking out about the eclipse?
No, it's an eclipse. They happen all the time. What's the big deal?
There's locusts and cicadas.
Oh, God, I didn't even think about that. So yeah. Darkness is going to fall upon the earth. There's going to be a plague of locusts.
Your firstborn son.
Frogs, and the seas are going to turn red with blood. Oh, no. I didn't even think about that. The same year as the cicadas, double cicadas. Oh, God.
It's going to be something. Well,
oh, that's all right. I'll be on a plane, so I don't really care.
Oh, yeah?
I'm going to miss it. Yeah, I'm going to miss it. So.
Well, I'll be here holding down the fort.
Yeah, I'm going to miss it this year. So.
We can do the podcast from my bunker in your plane.
Yeah, well, we'll have another episode before then, so at least people will get to hear, you know, one more show before the world ends. So they'll have something to listen to as long as their phones are charged, you know, when all the lights go out. So, all right, let's wrap this up before we get any deeper here. So, all right, guys, well, thanks for listening. We hope you'll share the show with your friends, your neighbors, anyone, you know, if you like the show, or even if you don't like the show, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes anyway, or send us an email or drop us a text on the hotline at 217-791-7859. You can also check us out on social media. You can find Cody and I on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. And I'm not even going to say TikTok, but anyway, don't forget, use the discount code podcast when you're shopping for books, tours, events, or whatever else you are looking for at AmericanHauntings.net. You'll also find the link there for Cody's shirt store, which is American Hauntings Clothing. And you can use that same code there too and get 10% off everything you order. So, turning it over to you, my friend, to wrap it up.
All righty. Well, this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and performed by Troy Taylor, and it was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com.
It's still there.
Yeah, right. You know, before the lights go out.
Comes to an end, yeah.
But as of now, it still features show notes, links, and photographs that go along with
it. Well, we've decided that in the apocalypse, we're still going to do the podcast. We're just going to have to do it live. So you'll have to come to our bunker wherever we are.
Yes.
And you can listen. We'll just do the podcast.
We'll have microphones. There'll be no electricity. But
yeah. But we don't even need them. We'll just shout.
Yeah.
So
thanks again for listening. We couldn't and definitely wouldn't do it without you, which is why you got to show up to the bunker.
That's so right.
Until next time, goodbye.
So long.
And see you
later.
Alrighty.
All right. Well, that was fun.